After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
Testing 1, 2, testing, testing 1, 2. So, hey, Patrick Lynn.
What?
Was that a rap?
Yeah.
What, DJ Dan? Hey everybody, Brian Collins here with another episode of the Pixel Hub Podcast, and man, have we got a good one for you today.
Oh yeah.
Hey, over there's Dan Lefebvre. Say hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Dan's doing great today, so am I. We got a great guest.
Oh yeah, really excited about this one.
Mm-hmm. I got to see this guy at SIGGRAPH 2015. He did a lecture. His name is Patrick Lynn, let me tell you that first of all, and he's from Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a layout artist there, which we're going to try and find out today what exactly that is. But what he talked about was his work on Inside Out. And if you mm-hmm. haven't seen that,
I'm pretty sure everybody's seen that. It's pretty safe to say.
the episode will still be extremely valuable, but we do recommend that you see it one way or the other.
So like that one person that's listening that hasn't seen it, go watch it.
Go watch it right now.
It's worth it.
But this lecture he gave was on the thing called camera structure and camera language, which is how you use your camera to tell, to support the story.
It's kind of like Klingon, right? Another language?
Sort of, right, but without the weird forehead thing.
That has nothing to do with the language.
Klingons had weird forehead.
Yeah, but it had nothing to do with the language. What? That?
This guy, what he was describing was so meticulous and so well thought out that I was just sort of stunned and compelled to have him on the show.
Yeah.
Because what he was talking about was it really makes you look at movies in a very different way.
Yeah.
I'm stopped short of saying that we're manipulated, but essentially that's what we are, into feeling certain ways about characters and situations mm-hmm. in movies, whether it's animated or live action, but how meticulous it becomes the approach to do that. Now, mm-hmm. we all know that, you know, acting is, you know, designed to elicit certain emotions from us, right?
Right.
And express those of the characters. But we hardly ever think of that same thing with where the camera is.
Yeah.
Like, how do you use the camera to create an emotion or to elicit mm-hmm. emotion?
Yeah, it makes sense.
And what this guy was talking about was just absolutely blew me away. It was amazing. So we're going to talk to him about all the stuff he talked about in his lecture and then some.
Nice.
So anyway, we'll go ahead and get on with it. Here is Patrick Lynn from Pixar. So, Patrick, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate you taking time to talk to us about your role on Inside Out, that wonderful show from Pixar.
Thank you.
We thought we'd start out with maybe talking about what you've done in the past. I noticed on your IMDb page that you've done a lot of major animated feature films as a layout artist. Can you tell us what exactly a layout artist is and how you came to be that and work for Pixar?
Sure. Well, I've been at Pixar for 18 years, and I work exclusively in the layout department.
Mm-hmm.
So layout basically is camera and staging. This is the two things that we do.
Okay.
But basically is we have to decide where to put the camera. I know a lot of people don't even know that computer animation says camera.
Right.
But we're actually more like live action than you would think. We have a digital set and we need to find a place to put the character and where do we stage the character to move them through the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So we are kind of like the choreographer of the camera and the characters.
Okay. And on Inside Out, what was your specific mm-hmm. role? Was it a layout artist or were you supervising layout artists?
I'm the director of photography for the camera. So usually on a live action film, the cinematographer or the director of photography is mm-hmm. one person. But in our world, computer animations, we actually have two people. We have one specialized in camera and one specialized in lighting. The reason is it's two separate disciplines in computer and it is actually at the opposite end of the pipeline. If I'm sure you've heard of light camera action, right? That's how you describe live action. But in computer animation, it's camera action light. So first is layout, and then is so we figure out the camera first, and then we go to action is actually is animation. That's how they're acting everything out. And the last part is lighting. So and the process is separate by months. So we kind of need two people to kind of oversee the front end and the back end productions.
Oh, that's interesting. So camera action lights, that's interesting. So have you worked on, or do you have an educational background in live action, or is it just animation?
Actually, my background is in live action. Just when I went to school, I got a film degree, a regular film degree. But it's live action. Just I love animation, but I can never draw. I'm not a very good drawing person. But so after I went to school up in the Bay Area, graduated with a bachelor film degree, and after that, there's not a whole lot of live action production up in the Bay Area. So well, there's two choices. One is move to LA like everybody else. Yeah, but I kind of like it up here. But what is in abundance up here is special effects houses, because Lucasfilm is up here. So somehow I got into doing special effects, doing ride film, like Star Tours, like shooting the film itself. So that's when I learned motion control camera. And then my first animation experience is working on IMAX ride film that has animated stop motion animated characters in it. And I met this animator from Skellington Productions. He just finished Nightmare Before Christmas. So that's my first experience with animation. And after I worked with him for like 6 months, and they're actually starting a new film, James and the Giant Peach. And that's how I kind of went over and helped him with that show. And that's my first feature animation experience. So it's kind of like, if you know stop motion, it's kind of halfway between live action and animation, because you still have all the physical props, you have physical sets. And back then, we actually shot it with physical film and camera. So so that is my first animation experience. And after that, that was back in 1995. And after I finished that film, Toy Story came out. And I thought, hey, that's good. I mean, I think I can do that one too. So I applied to Pixar, and then after three interviews and a year later, I started working as a layout artist at Pixar. It just so happened they were looking for someone who has live action background with experience with animation. So I was just like, have the right experience at the right time. But I don't know anything about computers. So so that was... Pixar trained me on everything. I still don't know much about computer, actually.
You know, we hear that a lot, actually, in artists. So I wanted to get to your SIGGRAPH lecture that you gave that that I was fortunate enough to attend. And it was called The Ins and Outs of Inside Out's Camera, right? The Pixar animated feature Inside Out. And I just found it fascinating, this idea of what you talked about was camera structure and what that entails, like three parts. Can you give us a breakdown of what camera structure is and a definition of those parts?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. So the camera structure, so layout basically is responsible for camera and staging, as I said before. And it's where we put the camera, where we put the characters. But we also determine what kind of lenses we use. Where is it a wide shot? Is it a close up? Is it a two shots? Is it a single? Is it over the shoulders? Is the camera moving or not moving? So all these is kind of grouped under our responsibilities. We're basically visual storytellers, kind of like storyboarding, but we're actually doing it in the computer. But so camera structure is just a way of organizing all those visual elements into something more coherent so that you can, so that the visual can support the story and the character emotions. So So that's basically is what a camera structure is. And inside out, the camera structure is basically grouped under three main parts. So we have a scale progressions, which is kind of like we have to determine how wide the shot is throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have visual intensity progressions, which visual intensity basically just goes with the main character's emotions, ups and downs throughout the film. And we also have visual language, of course. You know, that's sort of the visual language or the visual grammar. How do we, what kind of shot do we use and what does that mean? So that basically is the three parts.
Now, you mentioned the storyboards there. Do you work with the storyboards? Is it kind of like an iteration process that goes back and forth, or are you just involved in that process early on to determine what the camera will be in the shots?
So I try to not be too so when the first step is all these when they're storyboarding and all these iterations between story and editorial, mm-hmm. I try to kind of stay a little bit away from. I just let them work out the story first.
Mm-hmm.
I think their foremost job is to try and figure out the story, and it's my job to tell that story cinematically. So I try to not to be too interfere of their process, but I did pitch them the camera plan earlier. So the camera structure. This is what I was thinking. At this area, you know, when we can use wider shots, and here is tighter shots, you know, like, and here we want moving camera, and the other side, we don't want to move moving camera. So we kind of have a general plan that I pitch it to them, and they can take that into consideration, but it's not something to lock them down, because they really need to get the story working first. And when it gets to me, I will try to incorporate the camera plan into all the shots and make it more cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I mean, it's not an iterative process that would go back and forth between our two departments.
So in your lecture, you were discussing the mm-hmm. overall camera language that that was the approach that you took. And for those who haven't seen the movie Inside Out, right, it's about like a 10 or 11 year old girl whose emotions we get to see manifested, right, in this inner world. So hence the name Inside Out. And that you had actually promoted, or the idea was that you wanted to contrast these two worlds mm-hmm. visually and give them a different camera language or visual language so that it would help the audience identify. Can you talk about how that process kind of came about?
Sure. I always thought that, you know, all movies are based on some sort of conflict. Mm-hmm. So if we have cameras that can represent one side and the other, then mm-hmm. you can actually use that to support your story, right? So in Inside Out, is very obvious that it's like there's an inside world and an outside world,
right.
And the contrast between them is always very very apparent, right? Because like mm-hmm. the inside world is kind of weird. It's very small inside someone's mind, but it's also, since it's someone's mind, so it's also infinitely huge. The outside world, we're trying to play it more realistic. So and I think everyone on board from the very beginning is the contrast is what we love. And so that's why we try, even from a production design, there's a very contrast between the two worlds. And then to animations, how the characters are animated. The inside world characters are a little bit more cartoony, and the outside world is a little bit more, it's definitely more realistic. To how we plan the camera and to our lighting as well. How we plan the camera, the basic idea is pretty simple. It's the outside world is based on real location, Minnesota, San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought the camera should feel more realistic, you know. And mm-hmm. The opposite is the inside world. The inside world, you know, is in someone's mind, so it could be So let's go back to the outside world. So when I say more realistic, that basically means that it's a camera with more imperfection in it. Because right. computer animation, everything is so perfect. So the opposite of that is something that is just with imperfection in it. So we have handheld camera, we have a missed focus, we have exaggerated distortions. But inside world, we want it to be more perfect, kind of more like mm-hmm. not computer animated, but a little bit more control. So how we move the camera, we use more like track and dolly, mm-hmm. Reminiscent of the old film like Casablanca to Spielberg. You know, like everything mm-hmm. is very, every shot is very controlled. Yeah. Unlike the outside world, everything is more using Steadicam or handheld. There's no predetermined path. So the camera is kind of free to react to the character. So that's the basic difference between the two camera language.
Okay, and you also said that in order to prepare these looks, that you guys actually went out and purchased physical lenses in order to mm-hmm. get an accurate representation of what's yeah. imperfect, right? And that included yeah. things like lenses with lots of lens distortion and those that don't. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the process was like?
Sure. We didn't buy them. We just rented it for a day.
Okay.
But basically, we want to have two sets of distortions. Mm-hmm. It's very subtle, but I think hopefully people can feel it. So we went to a camera house in Berkeley, and we printed this really huge, I think it's about like 10 foot by 8 foot size of distortion chart. So basically, it's a grid.
Okay.
And we basically shot two sets of lenses with it, all the prime lenses. So what we got is the Cook S4 mm-hmm. and also the Aries Ultra Prime. These two sets of lenses, I think they do have pretty contrasting distortions. So after we shot each of the lenses, we can take that image back into our computer and we can measure exactly the curvature of the distortions, and we can model that distortion into our lenses.
Okay.
So that basically is that we base our distortion on a very distinctive lenses.
Hmm. Now, is that something that was obviously with Inside Out, like you said, it was pretty obvious mm-hmm. there's an inside world, outside world. Is that mm-hmm. idea of having that contrast there, is that something that's new to Inside Out, or had you done that in the past?
I have done that in the past. I also worked with Pete Docter on Up. I was also a director of photography, and that movie is instead of based on Inside and Outside World, that movie is based on Circle and Square. You might have heard of that, because when you look at Carl, mm-hmm. he's very square, and when we look at Russell, everything is very circular. So even the design of the house, even the flying house, right? The house is very square. But the balloon is very circular. So the whole movie is based off of the circle and the square, and what our production designer, Ricky Nerva, said is static versus a dynamic. So that's what the camera structure was based off of.
Hmm. Interesting. So can you tell us some more about some of the other parts of the camera structure? For example, the way that you guys were able to express a character's emotion, whether it was Joy or whether it was Riley, how you accomplished that with, say, composition or maybe vertical and horizontal lines, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is also from our production designer, Ralph Biggerson. He always talked about how when Riley's growing up in Minnesota, he wants everything feels very big and wide. And once again, in San Francisco, the world starts to close in on her. This is kind of the idea of scale comes in, mm-hmm. right? So the idea is Riley grows up in Minnesota, big and wide. So we have, in the beginning, our shots has lots of space around her, just make her feel a little bit more free. And once she gets into San Francisco, we start to introduce more vertical lines. The first big one was, of course, when she sees Golden Gate Bridge. And then when she gets into San Francisco, there's a lot of diagonal lines. And when she moves into her house, of course, you know, it's all mostly is vertical lines. Mm-hmm. And basically her world is getting closer and closer in on her until she got on the bus at the bus station in the end of Act Two. And the movie is based on contrast. So Joy's world is actually kind of opposite. In Act One, in the beginning, she's very cozy inside Riley's head. So mm-hmm. the shots are not too wide on her. But once she got flung out of headquarters in the end of Act One, the world becomes bigger and bigger. She becomes more and more lost because she has one, emotionally, she just has one goal, you know, is to make Riley happy and to get back to headquarters. But like the more she tried, the more she failed. And throughout Act Two, she got more and more lost until she fell into memory dump. That is like the widest shots that we use are around that area. We have like 6 or 7 wide shots around that area. It's just to represent like she is completely lost. Hmm. And then, of course, you know, after Act Two, when they get back, when she gets back to headquarters, everything hopefully achieves some sort of balance at the very end. Mm-hmm.
I remember yeah. also there was a really, really interesting thing that you guys had done with Riley and her parents, and it had mm-hmm. to do with blocking. And I think it was in during the discussion when you were you discussing the vertical lines when she yeah. moved to San Francisco, and how you always kept her between her parents in blocking. She was always seen sort of bookended by them as supporting her. But mm-hmm. as her father began to get the phone call to go to work and her life became much more stressful, you would take moments where she would be shown outside of the family, the two parents, right? Mm-hmm. And that you kind of use that. I found that really, really interesting. Can you talk about some more instances or where that kind of sort of visual language helped with the story?
Yeah. So there was one storyboard artist, you know, a lot of times when they draw the storyboards, I kind of mm-hmm. noticed that he always draw Riley in the center.
Yeah.
I kind of like that framing mm-hmm. because Riley is the center of the family unit, right. and her parents always surrounding her with love. So I kind of like that framing. Not every storyboard artist did that, but I thought, oh, I like that. But maybe what I can do, I can actually use that to represent a family unit. So 99% of the shot with when Riley was with both her parents, she is framed in the middle, flanked by her parents. And I can, taking it one step further, when in Act One, when she first moved to San Francisco, and Dad has to pick up this phone call, and they're all hugging, and then Dad has to put her down. Mm-hmm. I felt that, well, she probably felt a little bit left out. So, of course, you know, to support her feeling, I don't put her in the center. I kind of like Dad just put her to the side. And that is like kind of what I meant about like visual storytelling, you know, trying to use visual to support the story. And another thing we did is how we use close-up too. When I say those tight close-ups, as well, was talking about tight close-up that is like cropping the top of the forehead and the bottom chin is sort of like it's almost touching the bottom frame. Those are the really tight close-ups that mm-hmm. we use. Mm-hmm. Co-director Ronnie Del Carmen always want the closest shot on Joy is down in the memory dump when right. she realizes Riley needs more than her. She also needs sadness to be happy. So this is the most important moment in her life. This is when she realized, right? So I always thought that, well, that is really cool, but you know, I need to kind of make the whole language make sense. So I also use the close-up shots on the parents when they're doing parents' things. So basically it's when Riley is born, when Dad is yelling at Riley, when Mom is consoling Riley. You know, so when they're doing adult thing, I use those really tight close-ups to represent adulthood. So by doing that, then when we push into the closest shot on Joy down in the memory dump, now that shot is more more meaningful now because now she's just grown up. She's grown from like a child to adult. So it's moving from childhood to adulthood. And the same thing that we did. Also, so Riley also grew up too. When is the time that she grew up? So our story basically is saying that when you grow up, your emotions starts to mix. You have, so when her first joy and sadness, core, like mixed emotion core memory forms, that's mm-hmm. when she grows up. So after that shot, we cut to the tightest shot on her when she's hugging with her family. That's when she grows up. So we kind of use like subtle stuff like this to try and support the story.
Now, you had mentioned that there's another DP at the end of the pipeline. Do you find that these shots that you have framed early on, are there a lot of changes that happen after you hand it off, and then at the end of the pipeline they have to change some of the framing on that?
So how we work is after layout, we go into animation. And what we do have one person that is from layout that is sitting inside within animation. We call her the camera polisher. And she basically worked with animation, because sometimes with animation, when they start animating, we have to adjust the framing here and there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's the time that we do the adjustment. But once animation is done, the shot is locked. So going to animations, there's almost like no changes when we go from animation to lighting. Just everything, the lighting needs to work with very clean inventory. So all the sim needs to be done, all the texture needs to be there, all the camera is locked, all the animation is done. And so they can just light the shots.
So
by the time we get to lighting, there's no changes.
What sort of deliverables do you hand off then to animation?
So turning off to animation is, so we work really, really closely with editorial. So half of our production time in layout is working with editorial, finding the right cut that determine characters' locations in frame, characters' speed, and what the character does. And so we have to figure all those out to the frames. And then we gave that whole sequence to animations, like these are the shots. And sometimes they'll add like a few frames here or there, but you know that, basically, 99% that is the film that we actually end up producing. So this is what we give to animation. It's like a sequence with all the shots in it and with all the characters' locations and rough blocking and timing figure out.
If we could go back to this idea of contrast that sort of permeates not only the narrative, but as you explain the camera structure and the camera language and how that was manifested, were there other aspects, other departments that were upholding this in a similar way that they used contrast? For example, where was the music department who was scoring the movie, did they use contrast? Or maybe it was contrast used in the color scripting of the movie to help support emotions and provide identities and contrast like you were talking about?
I don't know about the music department, but I know that in production design, the color of the two worlds is very different. The inside mind was very very saturated, and the outside is kind of the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's more desaturated. And once we move through, I think at the end when Riley is like more in depression, when she's running away, the inside world becomes more desaturated, kind of matching the outside world. In production design is based on contrast. Also, the vertical versus horizontal. So in camera as well, and also animation. Animations, the inside world is a little bit more cartoony with all the emotions, and the outside world is more based on real physics, and lighting too. Yeah, lighting. The color, you can see that it's more saturated and desaturated, you know, between the two worlds. Everything is kind of based on contrast.
Now, what would you, if you were to offer some advice to people out there who are working on their own animations or films, What would some advice be that you would give to helping them build this sort of a camera structure strategy into their shots?
Sure. I think the first thing you do is really understand your story and understand your conflict. You know, because once you find the conflict, then you can see, okay, what kind of camera can represent mm-hmm. that conflict, mm-hmm. you know, one side or the other. And once you have, and that basically finding that difference between the conflicts, that is kind of like your visual language, right? Because you have the yin and the yang. Mm-hmm. And once you find that, then you can take a look at how the story progressed throughout the film. I can use that to kind of figure out how much to use one type of camera than the other type of camera. Hmm. That makes sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also lots of research, you know, so definitely, you know, just watch tons of movies.
Tons of Pixar movies.
Research is everything, you know. Like, yeah. I know sometimes it's hard to watch a lot of movies. You know, you can only watch like one movie a day, maybe. But yeah, try to watch as many movies as you can, and especially the movies that you love. Mm-hmm. You know, and watch it in without sound. That's also help. Hmm. If I've seen a film before, the second time I watch it, I should watch it without sound. That you just look at the visual, and sometimes you can see why is the camera moving in one shot and not the other, and kind of try to understand what is it trying to tell you visually. Hmm. The sound is very distracting. Yeah, if you watch the movie without sound, you can learn a lot more.
That's if you're focused on the visual.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, this is all just fascinating to me how not only, you know, is there something called a camera language, right, that you guys set up beforehand, but that the entire studio is sort of on board with this one theme, and that it's manifested in a similar way throughout this hour and a half that we're watching it is just really fascinating. And I know that our discussion has probably given our listeners a lot of good information just whenever they watch movies themselves or whenever they try and make them themselves and giving them some ideas. So we really appreciate you coming on and giving us all this great insights into how Pixar makes its movies.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Patrick.
All right.
My pleasure.
We'll see you later.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, that was Patrick Lin from Pixar. Hope you guys enjoyed that. I know I did. We got into some really cool things mm-hmm. that he touched on in the lecture about camera structure, camera language, this idea of scale progressions and changing you know, the look of a film as you go on and the contrast of the different world. I just thought that was really awesome. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear how they do that, but also kind of how they keep it separate. From other departments. Yeah. Ultimately it's the story that matters. Right. And his job is using the camera to tell the story. And so it was really interesting to hear how he does that, but then without messing with the story that was determined before through storyboards and from mm-hmm. the script and then there's, you know, the animation after them and mm-hmm. Which just drives the story even further. For me, it kind of put in perspective. I mean, you see a Pixar movie, you know that their stories are always rock solid and they're right. awesome movies. But you can kind of get a glimpse into why that's the case, because every single department is just thinking so much about pushing the story further. So every single artist that touches is pushing the story further. It's just, and the end result is amazing.
They're all pulling the same way, right? And it seems to me when he got off on talking about Up.
Uh-huh, right? Yeah.
And the sort of geometrical theme that they had going into it about circular and square.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like that what they do is they come up with some really broad, far-reaching theme like that, whether mm-hmm. it's that or whether it's the contrasts between the yeah. inside and outside world and yeah. Inside Out, and that idea sort of just permeates from the yeah. beginning throughout every department, uh-huh. and every department takes it and says, what the hell can we do with this?
Yeah, push it further. Keep pushing it. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. That's going, all right, we're the camera department. What yeah. can we do to further this contrast? We're yeah. the colorists, or we're the, you know, mm-hmm. even the sound. I mentioned the sound, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I'm sure it's the same.
If it was the same.
Yeah.
And it creates, in the end, I think this organic whole that feels like it's all one piece.
It's a masterpiece. Yeah.
It's a masterpiece, I guess.
Yeah.
I like that idea of the difference between live action, camera, action, lights, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That was really interesting. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's something that makes sense now that he said it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have really thought about it that way. I mean, I know, you know, the typical pipeline, mm-hmm. lighting is towards the end of the typical sure. pipeline, and pre-production is obviously at the beginning of the whole process, so mm-hmm. it makes perfect sense. But it's one of those things that you don't really think about that much. I think, at least for me, a lot of it is working with CG and creating, you know, CG worlds and things like that. It's really easy to get removed from real world fundamentals. Things like that a cinematographer like Patrick would know, mm-hmm. right? It's easy to kind of get detached from those when you're working in a virtual world.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the same token, I think that any of these rules, this approach can apply to just about whatever you're doing.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. Live action or animated. And it really is tough when you're like shooting a live scene to keep all of this in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it absolutely can be effective
mm-hmm.
if you just stop and think about it a little bit. Like, is the background too busy? Or are the horizontal lines in this doing what I'm wanting to do?
Yeah.
Right? Because whether we're aware of it or not, they're acting on us.
Yeah.
If there's a lot of vertical lines, we're going to feel
right.
as if the character, if that's what we're seeing, is sort of boxed in.
Yeah.
And if that's the intention, or if that's what you want, then
yeah.
you should strive to take that approach. And that was really good. I think he had some really good advice for, you know, that question you asked him about being, you know, advice for amateurs
mm-hmm.
and what they might have. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I think it's applicable not only to amateurs but professionals as well. I mean, obviously they're doing it in their own movies too. So it's mm-hmm. you mentioned the lines. I think that's something that's so interesting that if you think about the process that you'd have to go through to come up with that, it's not looking at the shot and saying, "Oh, we want this to feel more compressed, so we're going to put in vertical lines or horizontal lines or whatever sort of mood we want." It's before you even compose the shot, you know that you want in this part of the story, you want it to be it, or it's going to have this sort of emotion mm-hmm. from the viewer, mm-hmm. right? So what are the methods that we can do in order to pull that emotion out of the viewer?
Mm-hmm.
And so much of it is subtle. Like, I'm yeah. going to have to go back and watch it again to see the differences between the inside world and the outside world. I mean, I can, just from the trailer that you can see online and from those types of things, it's really easy to see some of the more obvious differences, the focus and
yeah.
some of the imperfections and things like that. But some of the subtleties that he was talking about in the camera differences and mm-hmm. the
one being distorted the progression. More than the other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That, and also even just the shots, right, where he's talking about the outside world is, the inside world is, especially in the beginning, it's kind of more, not, he didn't use it's the word more, claustrophobic, it's but it's, oh, yeah. but it's smaller, right? Even mm-hmm. though it's a huge world inside the mind, but it's smaller because it's inside your head.
Mm-hmm. Like they had more medium shots.
Yeah, yeah. The length of the inside world
in the beginning, right? And then a lot of wider ones on the outside world of her moving and them driving in the car and moving from Minnesota to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And then at some point, those flip.
They flip, right.
Right.
And you don't even, it's not something that you're going to notice, but it's, in talking to Patrick, it really kind of clicked in my mind, at least, of you're not going to come up with that as you're working on the movie, like in the heat of it, right? It's something that you're going to come up with beforehand. You're going to know that this is the progression that we want to take with the story. How can we use the camera? Like you're saying, how can we use the camera to support that? Oh, we can do that by doing medium shots and that approach. It's not, oh, this shot would look great as a medium shot. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're probably certainly going to have more success the more pre-planning you do, right?
Yeah,
I don't think it's necessarily impossible. It just takes... It takes practice, I think. You can do it on the fly, but you're right. If you really want it to be, if you want to get those subtleties, you know, you really have to do it ahead of time.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to mention that we have an article on the blog that's a synopsis of a Patrick's lecture that we put together, and it's got some images from trailers and stuff that we pulled to show these ideas of the contrast and the camera differences and the vertical and horizontal lines and all that stuff. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes so you guys can go check it out. But it was pretty interesting, I think, overall.
Great interview, Patrick.
So, thanks for listening to the Pixel Hub Podcast, the official podcast of Digital Tutors. If you have any comments or questions, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes so other people can find it better. And you can find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks for listening.